in the United States in the early 50s, there were five or six automobile manufacturers, the thesis that I developed was that you were going to end up with only two or perhaps three manufacturers in the United States. And of course, that's what ultimately happened. In my senior year, again, even though I always wanted to go to law school, in my senior year, I had some thoughts of going on and getting a master's and a PhD in economics. I never really followed those out.
It was very natural for you to be thinking of the automobile industry with the proximity to Detroit and all the spin-offs in Cleveland.
Yeah, well, Michigan, of course, was the leading school for the study of the automobile industry generally. And a lot of the money in Ann Arbor, a lot of the reason that the University of Michigan is great is because the auto industry poured a lot of money into Ann Arbor. Just to give you one minor example, which isn't directly academically related, the University of Michigan Marching Band was sponsored by Buick. When I say sponsored, Buick donated money for uniforms. When we went on road trips, Buick paid the cost of the trips. When Buick had their, Buick was located in headquartered in Flint, Michigan, when Buick had their annual dealers conventions in Flint, Michigan, the University of Michigan Marching Band came up to perform for them. We had one incident when I was there where we went down to Columbus to play Ohio State, and the Michigan Marching Band had a lot of formations, and we had a formation that was that spelled out Buckeye, B-U-C-K, and underneath the B-U-C-K there was put the I. And then we marched the I into the middle of B-U-C-K to spell out Buick. And in those days, that type of commercialism was virtually unknown. And I'm not sure you'd even do that today. The Buick people just thought it was tremendous. I actually marched in Ohio State Stadium twice. One of my great memories, we were there. Ohio State was undefeated. Michigan had lost one game. If Michigan won this game, they would go to the Rose Bowl, and if Ohio State won, of course, they'd be undefeated and go to the Rose Bowl. And Ohio State had as their premier player Howard Cassidy, Hopalong Cassidy. And they were heavily favored in the game. It was then Woody Hayes, who was the Ohio State coach, his second or third year. And he had an undefeated team. And Michigan, on a couple of fluke plays, having been outplayed in the first half, on a couple of fluke plays, had a lead. And the Ohio State Stadium started singing to the tune of the Ohio State alma mater, "Oh, come, let's sing Ohio's praise and sing goodbye to Woody Hayes."
Ooh, pressure.
And, that was, when you know, probably 60,000 or 70,000 people were singing that, it made an impression. Now, Ohio State won the game, went to the Rose Bowl, and won the Rose Bowl, but
or you might not have made it alive either.
Yes, yes. So I remember that. We went to play Michigan State one year, and at that time there was no cross-country television. I mean, television, these relay towers didn't take everything across country, but this was one of the early games in which the eastern and midwestern parts of the country were linked by television. And this was a nationally, quote, close quote, televised game in the sense that every place that it could reach, they reached. And I remember Dr. Ravelli telling us now, "This is the first game we've ever been on television like this. And if they zoom in the cameras on you and you make the wrong step, there will be millions of people watching your wrong step." He said, "But the one who will count the most is that I will be watching your wrong step." But I remember we played at, I guess the one of the early games where they televised that. Michigan did not have a very good team, so I was there. The one year they did, when they lost to Ohio State in that game. But by and large, we didn't go to the Rose Bowl any of the 4 years that I was there. We had great other teams, swimming and baseball and other sports, but not in football.
Did you have time to go on dates much in college?
Oh, yeah. I did a lot of dating in college. All the way through through college, dated various groups in college. But I didn't meet my wife there. But, girls from all over. Michigan, in those days as today, draws from all over the country. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of people, a lot of students at Ann Arbor who were all over. And dated girls from Falls Church, Virginia, and Erie, Pennsylvania, and Columbus, Ohio, and Chicago, Illinois, and I don't remember where else.
Could you tell us about some of your honors?
Well, I was in the, I guess the major honor was academic. I graduated with honors and distinction in economics. Those are separate honors, connotes grade point average. Michigan did not in those days, I don't think they do today, have cum laude. Mm-hmm. So they had honors and high honors. And I graduated with honors, and then within your major, you could graduate with distinction. And I graduated with honors and distinction in economics. I was a member of I think it was Alpha Phi Omega, the service committee. Mm-hmm. I guess those were the major honors. I got some kind of an honor in ROTC, but I don't know what it was.
Were you ever employed anywhere, you know, any time in high school or college or any time up until the time you graduated?
In the summers, I was employed every summer, beginning in about 10th, 3rd grade in high school. Mm-hmm. At different places, I worked one summer or part of one summer at a drugstore. I worked two summers in a foundry equipment company in downtown on the flats in Cleveland. They had blueprints of all of their designs going all the way back to the last century. And they wanted to microfilm all that material. And so my college roommate and I, Larry Schreiber and I, worked there, and what we did was we prepared these blueprints for microfilm and sent them ahead of the package and sent out. And when they came back, we had to examine the microfilm against the blueprints to make sure the corners hadn't been folded over, and that there were five pages of blueprints, that they had microfilmed all five pages, that they were clear, so they could destroy the blueprints. And we spent a whole summer doing that in this old foundry equipment building where they built this foundry equipment. It was on the second or third floor of a three-story portion of the building, in a room that had one small window and no air conditioning. It was not a very good experience, but it was interesting. I also worked at some other miscellaneous jobs. I worked on playgrounds. My mother was a playground director for, I don't know how many years, 15, 20 years. And a couple of summers I worked on playgrounds, on one of her playgrounds, as a counselor. So I did those kinds of things.
So after you... Is there anything else you want to tell us about your years at Michigan?
Not that I can think of. I still have a lot of the material from Ann Arbor at home.
Uh-huh.
Still, I'm a saver, so
well,
I have
those
all this
have
stuff.
To be special years.
I have all this stuff saved up. Four other members of our family have subsequently gone to Ann Arbor. So school.
So then after Ann Arbor?
Well, I went to law school. Mm-hmm. I entered law school in the fall of 1955. Mm-hmm. Spent 3 years at Harvard. Graduated in 1958 from Harvard. Looking back on it, I can see how little I knew at the time. Harvard was a great place to go to school, partly because of the faculty, which was outstanding, partly because of the caliber of the student body. And of course, Harvard was very large, as law schools go. At that time, it was the largest day law school in the country, and they still do. We had 510 entering in our class, graduated 460 something.
That's amazing.
Class. Now they graduate over 500 in the class. And it came from all over. The law school, I thought, was a great experience. Not everybody liked the experience. Some of my classmates affirmatively disliked the experience.
Why?
They felt it was too grinding and too competitive, and not enough time for reflection and so forth. I remember lots of things, of course, about Harvard, too. I was rooming with my fraternity brother, Stan Bernstein, and I had been dating a girl in my senior year at Michigan, and when I went away to Harvard, on one long football weekend, Stan and I decided it would be nice to go back to Ann Arbor. And so we drove from his car from Boston to Ann Arbor. I guess it was the last time I did it, for a football weekend. And we drove back on a Sunday, and we stopped at Syracuse, which is where his sister was going to school. And then we started back from there and ran into a hurricane. And the main road across Massachusetts, there were no turnpikes in those days. The main road across Massachusetts was rained out. And we had to go across the back mountain road in the western part of Massachusetts to get back. And we got in something like 2 o'clock in the morning on Monday. Had to be in class Monday morning at 9 o'clock. I think those of us, people who knew us, thought we were out of our minds to be round trip to the football weekend in the fall, in the first year. There were a lot of fairly well-known people in our class. Probably the name that has the most name recognition was Ralph Nader, who was a classmate. I did not know him in law school. Richard Goodwin was in my class. Richard Goodwin was later an advisor to President Kennedy. The Alliance for Peace in Central America was a Richard Goodwin idea. He was a speechwriter for the president. He was married to the Nobel Prize winning historian.
Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Doris Kearns Goodwin. Dick comes back to the year. I see him. And I did know Dick Goodwin. In fact, he was in one of my study groups. He had some very interesting study groups. A number of my classmates have been very active in Jewish affairs. One of my classmates was a fellow named Marty Ginsburg. His wife is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg, she was a year behind me in law school, and I knew her there, and I knew Marty there. One of my classmates was president of the American Jewish Committee chapter in St. Louis. One of my classmates...
What was his name?
Ben Uchitel. Mm-hmm. One of them was president of the American Jewish Committee chapter in Detroit. That's David Page. One of them was president of the American Jewish Committee chapter in Los Angeles, and is now the number two person and will probably be the next head of, next lay head of the American Jewish Committee. That's Bruce Raymer. Several others have been very active in the American Jewish Committee circles. A number of my classmates have become presidents of their congregations in various places. When I was in Dallas for the UAHC biennial last fall, I went into a classmate of mine who I had not seen since we graduated from law school. So that's 30 years almost. Who lived in Portland, Oregon. And he was there because he was the immediate past president of his congregation. So there are a lot of my classmates were active in various aspects of the community. One of my classmates, Bill Mallon, is one of my partners here in the office. I did know Bill.
What percentage of your class was Jewish? Do you have a little recollection of that?
Somewhere between 30% and 40%.
30% and 40% were Jewish,
yeah.
And that in
wow.
Probably
30%.
Hmm.
A lot of them became professors. One of our good friends is the dean. Was the dean at the Carl Sellinger. Became dean at the University of, at the College of Law, the University of West Virginia, and still is a professor there. Another one became dean of the. George Washington Law School. He was Jewish. Another one became dean of the University of Buffalo, SUNY at Buffalo Law School, or whatever that law school is called. Also Jewish. A number of them became judges. One of my classmates, there are a number of them were federal judges, both the appellate court and district court. And I think that's probably true of most of the law school classes. Our class wasn't exceptional in that way.
Well, one of the thoughts is that people that generations today, the Jews go into law rather than studying the Talmud, that it's the same kind of thought process. Is there
the difference today from when I was in law school? Was that when I was coming out of law school, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. There was a lot of anti-Catholicism also, just generally regular. And so in most cities, in most major law firms, in the 1950s, if they had any Jewish lawyers at all, and many of them did not, those lawyers would be in one of two areas. They would either be tax lawyers or they would be labor lawyers. And Pittsburgh is a perfect example of that. I did the 1963, after we moved to Pittsburgh, I've been here 2 years, I did the study of the law firms for the American Jewish Committee's Executive Suite Discrimination Program. There were at that time six large law firms in Pittsburgh. Large is a relative term. They weren't very big in those days. Of the six, three had no Jews at all. And of the three that had Jews in them, our firm was one of them. Carl Chern, of course, was Jewish. Carl was a tax lawyer. Reed Smith was another. Len Scheinholz was there. He's a labor lawyer. And I forget which was the other firm that had a Jewish lawyer in it.
What year was this?
This was in the Buchanan firm. And it was Berger, and he was a tax lawyer. And so you had, I guess he did corporate stuff too, the tax lawyer. So you had, coming out of the law schools in those days, you faced anti-Semitism. In Massachusetts, it was against the law in 1958. To ask questions in interviews on religion. I went to one interview of a law firm from, I want to say Chicago, but that might not be right. Partner who was interviewing me said, there are certain questions that we are not permitted to ask in Massachusetts, and I'm not going to ask those questions yet. But you need to know that I am going to be inviting you back for an interview with Chicago, in Chicago, wherever it was. And there, the law is different, and I will be able to ask you those questions. You may want to volunteer the information here. He said, we don't take any account of it, but we try to keep a balanced firm. Balanced firm didn't mean they tried to keep 50-50 Jewish. Balanced firm meant they tried to only have one or two Jews. Another lawyer interviewing me from a firm in Cleveland, which at that time had no Jews, knew I was from Cleveland, and he asked my mother, he didn't know my family, he asked my mother's maiden name. Of course, her maiden name is Humans, and that's a neutral name. And then he asked about my middle name, because my middle initial is Z, and I didn't spell it all out. I guess I did spell it out, and he said, Zalman, he said, that's a very interesting name. What kind of a name is that? And obviously, he was searching for whether I was Jewish or not. And I said, that's an old family name from a great uncle who was German. I played a little game with him. I was not interested in his firm, but you used to get those kinds of behind-the-scenes type of questions. And even in a law firm like ours, I was only the second Jew ever hired.
And what year was that?
I was actually hired in 1960. I was joined the firm in 61, and we had no Catholics until 1968 in this firm. And if you look at most of the other large firms in Pittsburgh, and also in comparable cities, you will find that same pattern. If a firm was a Protestant firm, it might have one or two Jews and no Catholics until the late 60s. So it wasn't only Jewish, it wasn't only anti-Semitism, it was anti-technology. That was different. Today you don't see that. And of course women were, I think we may have had, out of the class of starting at 900, we may have had 8 or 9 women in the class. We probably graduated from 6 or 7.
You started with 900 women?
No, we started
with 900 people.
We started with 500.
And you graduated with 450.
And we graduated about 460.
That was so little attrition.
Yeah, very little attrition.
I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. There are going to look to your right, look to your left. One of you won't be here next year. Attitude. But by the late 50s, they had the admissions process. It was a fairly sophisticated kind of process, apparently.
And I'm sorry, how many women?
We may have entered 9 or 10 women. We probably graduated 5 or 6 or 7. Today, the classes are about 50-50. There was one black in our class, a fellow named Theodore Newman, who later became a judge in Washington, D.C. There were virtually no other minorities. Of course, Jews were looked upon as minority in those days. Today, Jews aren't looked upon as a minority, I guess, but in those days, Jews were the minority. But it was totally different coming out of school.
Was it very difficult for you during your years at Harvard, or did you really have to?
I had to work. I mean, I had to work hard. It turned out that I made my best grades in my senior year. Far and away my best grades. I did well in my first year, slipped a little bit in the second year, but in the third year I made my best grades. As I said earlier, one of the great things then about Harvard, and one of the great things I think now, was the caliber of the faculty. One of my classmates today is on the faculty at Harvard, at least one. That's Arthur Miller. He's pretty well known for PBS.
Older.
No, Arthur and I are the same name. For PBS and other things like that. So he would be an example of today's faculty. That's great. But in those days, we had some giants in the law who were on the faculty. Some of them were really superb teachers. Others were not so good as teachers, but they were great to them. To listen to Paul Freund, who was the great constitutional law professor, just ends. So you got good training that way, good training from your classmates.
Was there a certain kind of law that you were more interested in there?
Not that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the area that I practice in is not anything that I really ever thought about.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good general training. There were a lot more required courses then. I guess there are more courses taught because the law has expanded a lot since then. But the law school itself was a very good training. You don't learn much substantive law in law school that sticks with you. You learn some, obviously. But what you learn is a method of approaching problems. Mm-hmm. That's what law school is teaching. Come out with that knowledge that you can approach most every problem. That's why you see so many lawyers in non-profit organizations and so forth. It's not because they're lawyers as such, it's because the kind of intellectual training you get is a problem-solving type of training. Harvard was very good at that. There are a lot of other law schools that are very good at that too.
Do you have honors at Harvard?
Yes, I graduated from Harvard cum laude. If I had done in my first 2 years what I did in my third year, I would have graduated with higher honors than that. But I graduated cum laude. One of the nice things about my experience at Harvard was my brother was an undergraduate at Harvard College while I was at Harvard Law School. He entered Harvard College the same year I entered Harvard Law School. And so we spent 3 years together in Boston. When I think about it, both of my parents were teachers. My brother did not have a scholarship. I did not have a scholarship. In my last year, I took some scholarship and fellowship money. But I did not have one. It's amazing how my parents ever did it.
Did they have to sacrifice
oh, yes.
things for themselves?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, put us both in school, we're both at the same time.
And then after Harvard?
Well, my first year at Harvard, I was there because they hadn't called me in the military. And once I was already commissioned. Reserves. And near the end of my first year, I wrote a letter and asked for another year. So he let me go on for a second year. The rule when I graduated from college was that you had to be in the Air Force no later than 2 years after you graduated from college. So I expected to finish up 2 years and then go on to the Air Force and come back. And about 3 months before the end of my second year, it changed the rules and allowed you to finish graduate school. So I finished graduate school, and I went down to Washington to the personnel office of the Air Force and the Pentagon and asked them, please call me right away. And so they said, when do you take the bar? And I said, the last week of July. And they called me into the Air Force the second week of August. So I went graduating from Harvard to the Air Force that same summer.
Did Did you have to go, were you committed for a certain length of time?
I was committed for 3 years. Originally that commitment was only 2 years, and then they increased it to 3 years. I learned a number of years later that some of my classmates, who had the same, a couple of my classmates who had the same commitment I had, had challenged the Air Force on the extension and had gotten relief and only served 2 years. Either wasn't smart enough or didn't realize you could challenge it, and most people did not challenge it. If I had challenged it and only served 2 years, I would not have been my life. So
everything
worked
for
out
a reason.
Yeah.
Was it difficult for you to go into the Air Force after law school? You know, your thinking changes so much in those 3 years from
not
college.
Not particularly. I went into the Air Force as a judge advocate. The judge advocate general. So.